Welcome to the Real Clear Politics Takeaway for Friday, February 3rd. I'm Andrew Walworth. This week, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy was in the spotlight, meeting with President Joe Biden on raising the federal debt ceiling and winning a House vote to expel Representative Ilhan Omar from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. For his part, Biden had his beach house searched, and former Vice President Mike Pence may be next, as the classified documents scandal continues to make everyone involved look just bad. And speaking of bad looks, we'll discuss the most recent revelations from the Twitter files. Joining me to talk about all this are Carl Cannon, Washington Bureau Chief for RCP, White House correspondent Phil Wegman, and Emily Jashinsky, culture editor of the Federalist News site. So, Phil, Kevin McCarthy seems to be having a moment, certainly wasn't center stage in Washington this week. So let's just start with his meeting with Joe Biden on Wednesday. That was the first time he's gone to the White House in his new capacity. How did it go? And did McCarthy accomplish what he wanted from that meeting?
If the goal was to finally meet the president as the new Speaker of the House, then yeah, mission accomplished. But when he walked out of the West Wing to talk to all of us, he said again that he wasn't going to negotiate in the press, and things stand pretty much where they were before he walked into the Oval Office. The White House says that they are not going to negotiate over the debt ceiling. McCarthy's caucus in the House, they're hell-bent on negotiating because this is their main leverage point. And as things look now, we know that the debt ceiling is likely going to hit its limit sometime this summer. So buckle up for another 5 months of this messy back and forth.
Well, Emily, he did say that he said we both laid out some of our vision, which is always interesting to think of these two guys having any vision at all, but good for them. And he said, I can see we could find some common ground. I mean, was there any sort of movement, anything that sort of opens up an idea that that they may be able to come to some agreement, at least between the two of them?
It's predictable spin, but I think it's interesting nonetheless as a kind of road marker that the spin is already beginning, because that's how it's always going to have to be sold, both from Biden's perspective and McCarthy's perspective, because McCarthy is simply not going to get what his 20-person caucus wants out of these negotiations. They know that, he knows that, but he's going to have to get them more than what they might otherwise, than the White House wants to give up. But Biden really has the upper hand. I think you saw that from the press statements. McCarthy went out and told reporters that they only talked about the debt. The White House went out and told reporters that they talked about a range of issues. So I think that's what we're going to see over and over again as the negotiations are ongoing. Some Republicans like Thomas Massie have suggested just passing a CR as a backup because the negotiations seem so difficult with Kevin McCarthy with such a slim majority, and having not even the full support of his caucus at that, with the one person motion to vacate. I think Massey's take is probably a wise one, because you can already see the spin beginning when it comes to McCarthy and Biden hashing these things out.
Carl, you know, the standard line in Washington is that the debt ceiling is sort of the third rail of politics, and didn't go well for the Republicans last time. They'll have to cave eventually on this one. But is it different this time? Because maybe it is. Who knows?
Neither party ever seems to learn a thing. And they know they're going to eventually have to sign this. And what they'll do is close national parks and lay off furlough all these people. All the workers who they furlough will get their back pay. People whose vacations were ruined won't get their vacation back. It makes the United States look like a third world country. Nothing ever changes. You'd think that they would learn, but they don't learn. For Biden especially, it must be a sense of deja vu all over again, because when he was vice president, newly installed as vice president, in the first weeks of Barack Obama's administration, they would go up, they were having these budget negotiations, and Obama would throw out ideas, something that John Boehner thought he could live with, and he'd take it back to the caucus and they'd vote him down publicly, embarrassing him. Or one time Eric Cantor said, don't even take that to the conference. And Boehner had a more pliable Republican caucus than this guy does. McCarthy doesn't have much room to maneuver. Obama, by the way, when I saw that Biden contradicted Kevin McCarthy, I remember, because Biden would say publicly in these first days, really, oh, if they have good ideas, I'll listen to them. Privately, he was looking at these guys and say, hey, I won the election. There are consequences. Screw off. So You know, they didn't trust after that. They never trusted Obama again, but they realized that he could always outmaneuver them publicly. He was just cleverer and smoother and more popular than they were. It seems to me that some of those dynamics are present again.
Emily, is it going to be different this time, or is it just more sort of like wrestling and then the debt ceiling gets approved and we go further into a debt and this just continues?
Yeah, I think Carl's exactly right. We're seeing basically very similar dynamics, echoes of those Boehner-Obama negotiations, because Republican voters have making a dent in the debt in mind. And that's what their politicians want them to do. But nobody wants to touch Medicare and Social Security. Therefore, the debt negotiations, in terms of being substantial and meaningful, are dead on arrival, no matter who is talking about them. So it's a matter of squeezing some ticky-tacky stuff out. Philip, I think, in his reporting has picked up on something really interesting. It's like what folks, including Chip Roy and Russ Vogt, some of the kind of thoughtful conservative architects of this thrust are saying. They want to cut some of the woke stuff, basically. Russ Vogt's group has put out an agenda to cut the quote woke bureaucracy. And so that, I think, is going to be something that McCarthy's under a lot of pressure. If he wants to keep his speakership and be able to even make these negotiations, be a part of the negotiations, he's going to be under a lot of pressure to get Biden to cut some stuff like that. And that might be the thing that's able to placate those 20 members that held up his speakership.
Let's be clear on one thing, though, Andy. That won't do a thing about the federal deficit or the long-term debt, which is getting worse. It's getting worse because we have inflation. And so Social Security just... their cost of living increased was pretty significant, announced in January. People are getting larger checks. They're happy with that. But the federal interest on the debt is now higher than it was. So all the economic markers are bad. What they really need to do is get more people working again and get inflation under control. And these negotiations don't have much to do with that.
But Phil, to go back to Emily's point, because you did write about this, and it is interesting. Tying these sort of culture issues to this particular negotiation is kind of a new wrinkle on this sort of thing. Just explain the rationale behind that and whether you think that will work.
So the current House Freedom Caucus certainly has its roots in the Tea Party, but there's a difference between those guys' activism against Ryan and Boehner, the former House speakers, and their current fight. This is not just about fiscal issues, because the current crop of conservative dissidents, they realize that without the Senate and without the presidency, they're unlikely to make the significant dents in the federal budget that would be necessary, you know, touching entitlements. So Chip Roy and others, they see, like Emily pointed out, an opportunity to cut back on some sort of a woke spending. And the wrinkle here is, yes, there is some fiscal restraint, but they see this as part of a larger effort to defund or curb the bureaucracy that they believe is violating individual rights and freedoms. And I think that what we're going to find out in the weeks and months ahead is, do these dissidents actually have a confrontation with reality? Do they continue to ask for the whole loaf when it's not possible? Or do they realize, you know, I might just have to take not even a few slices, but maybe just the crumbs so that I can set myself up for actual reform later on? What I heard from members of the McCarthy mutiny just hours after the speaker met with Biden is they were incredibly excited, and they saw the debt ceiling negotiations as an opportunity to leverage some sort of concessions out of the White House. Obviously, their expectations, we're going to figure out what those are, but there seems to be a sense that they know that if they fail after having asked for so much, like the motion to vacate, like the seats on different committees, and they really force McCarthy to drive a hard bargain, well, then they will own the failure. So there does seem, at least at the offset, as we're, you know, preparing for this 5-month marathon, they have invested in McCarthy's success, because, you know, they know they're going to be the ones holding the bag if this, you know, all goes south.
Well, Emily, before we move off of the House, yesterday, Representative Omar was removed from the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He's required a floor vote, unlike the previous guys who got booted. So is this a victory for the Republicans and especially for McCarthy? He held his caucus together. He got something done.
It's a short-term victory for McCarthy. The long-term is the real question. And I think that's why you've seen members, Freedom Caucus people like Matt Gaetz and Ken Buck, no pun intended, buck on this question of whether it was the right move. Now, Buck eventually kind of came around on that after talking to McCarthy. And Ilhan Omar made an appearance on, I think it was CNN, on the Sunday morning talk show circuit to say she was unaware of anti-Semitic tropes that she had, you know, sort of unwittingly invoked in previous tweets. I think that's a very dubious question, as was her comparison of the United States to Hamas, which is what has her in hot water with hot Republicans. But it's a huge question for Republicans who are upset about what happened to Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar and with the January 6th committee. They think their voters are demanding, you know, sort of an eye for an eye, scalp for a scalp, and whether, and that's true. I think Republican voters have perennially been sick of Republicans not doing stuff like this because it's happening to them. But there's a big open question about what kind of precedent this sets and if this is putting the House on a very slippery slope towards even more dysfunction than exists right now, to the extent that that's possible by breaking or doing the tit for tat with a longstanding norm. And we saw Rashida Tlaib literally crying on the House floor over the vote on Thursday. So Democrats are going to mine it for all of the political gold they think it's worth too.
And we saw the White House immediately do that, by the way. Today, when they were pressed on this question, the press secretary said that Ilhan Omar was a highly respected member of that committee and that she had apologized for her past mistakes. The thing is, though, there's other high profile members who have made anti-Semitic comments and also apologized, namely Marjorie Taylor Greene. And the White House continues to enjoy, and probably for good reason, to go after her. There's a clear double standard. And right now, it seems like this is a race to the bottom.
Well, AOC played the race card, too.
She had a kind of a tantrum on the House floor and said it was racist and it was sexist. And it's the only reason they were after her because she was a woman of color. You know, Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell, the first two scalps that McCarthy took, were white men. And so that's a statement that you think somebody would have trouble making with a straight face. But none of the Democrats did. They are all able to read from that talking point. To both the point that Phil and Emily made, though, here's the problem with it. It doesn't end here. So if, you know, next time Democrats get the House, they'll have a list of it. It won't be three people. Now it'll probably be 10. And the number of fringy people in each conference is at any given time about, you know, 10% of each side, at best I can tell. I mean, you could come up with 30 flaky people, and you can, and the names just come roll off your Matt Gaetz, you know, Maxine Waters, these people who are given to bizarro comments and bad behavior. There's too many of them. There's not just three. So they went after these three, but it's clear that the Democrats are angry about it, just as the Republicans are angry about it, and they're already planning their retaliation.
Emily, you wrote this week about Twitter, new revelations in the Twitter file, and this group, Hamilton 68. Hamilton 68, do I have that right?
Yes.
Sounds like a car or something. I don't know. But what is Hamilton 68, and tell me the story.
Hamilton 68 is named after what Alexander Hamilton wrote in Federalist 68, warning of foreign interference in American elections. But it was a group, it was a project of something called the Alliance for Securing Democracy, which was in and of itself a group associated with the German Marshall Fund. These are groups that are stocked with ex-government, ex-intelligence, ex-State Department people, John Podesta, Bill Kristol, very high-powered former FBI government officials, that type of group. And they were touting in the media a list that they kept secret. They basically just said, everyone, you have to trust us. This is a list based on methodology that tracks Russian interference or Russian intelligence operations on Twitter. Nobody could ever see who the users were that were implicated in disseminating information, Russian intelligence information. It was used often to discredit totally organic trends. Like one time there was a trend called hashtag release the memo that was about Devin Nunes's since largely vindicated memo. Even the Columbia Journalism Review wrote about it this week as being pretty solid. That was discredited as a Russian intelligence operation because Hamilton 68 said, it's blowing up our dashboard. You know, our dashboard is all lit up because Russian bots are disseminating the story, and accounts that are susceptible to Russian intelligence operations are disseminating the story. The angle I took is that Twitter knew about this in October of 2017. Yoel Roth himself reverse engineered the Hamilton 68 methodology, got the list, and Twitter publicly, when asked by Adam Schiff and Dianne Feinstein, you know, to look at this list, they cited Hamilton 68 and said, we have all this evidence from this group affiliated with the German Marshall Fund suggesting that Russia is, you know, just completely controlling Twitter. They said, we can't tell you because that list is not public, so we can't evaluate its veracity. Well, of course they had, and they had said that the list was totally bogus, that it was mostly created, or that was mostly compiled of people that were neither Russian nor bots, and Yoel Roth himself said it was bullshit. Excuse the language, said it was BS.
Well, Yoel Roth said that, Emily, but only privately. This right, wouldn't exactly. Say a word publicly. And this latest Twitter fuzz, the internal thing, it actually makes Twitter, these Twitter censors look better than they've ever looked before in my view, because they were honest with each other. They did the work. They realized, but they were kind of afraid of these people. They had gotten in bed with the American intelligence community, and they were like the old fable of the guy riding on the back of the tiger. And now they were afraid of challenging it because these same Democrats who were pushing them were going out and talking about censorship and talking about how Twitter needs to maybe broken up and all these, they were being pressured by the Democrats to censor and to be careful and to close down speech. And yet here, this thing they knew, and if they'd have blown the whistle on it, they were actually afraid of the Democrats and afraid of the FBI. That's what came through to me through the latest Twitter files.
And remember,
is that right, Emily? Is that you're reading of it too?
Exactly. Yeah. And Yoel Roth had been meeting, we know from earlier Twitter files, with the FBI repeatedly throughout, like weekly throughout some of the same period. And so it's a huge indictment of, in Matt Taibbi's report, all of these media outlets who ran tons of Hamilton 68 stories for a very, very long time. It's so hard to disentangle from the predicate of the Trump-Russia narrative. It's basically baked into the cake because they were constantly saying the Russian influence operations were spreading pro-Trump, anti-Schiff messaging, anti-Clinton messaging, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a huge part of the predicate for the Russia collusion narrative. And a lot of media outlets took the bait when they should have been way, way, way more skeptical of a former FBI special agent, Clint Watts, who's an MSNBC and NBC News contributor, saying, hey, I've got this thing, can't tell you who the people are, but trust me, it's evidence of X. And the media just went with that for a really long time and expressed none of the skepticism that normal journalistic standards would insist that you apply.
Phil, what do you think?
Yeah, if your mother tells you she loves you, you're supposed to check it out. But if a former spook tells you that he has evidence of Russian misinformation but doesn't show you the receipts, you're just supposed to print it in the New York Times. It's a pretty piss poor standard. I think that, yeah, Twitter does look better for actually doing the legwork. Their original sin here is that they also seem to have bought the narrative that there was collusion and then wimped out on going public with their research, which showed that all of this was overplayed when it comes to Hamilton 68. I think that there's a comeuppance. You know, Bob Woodward has been out there talking about how the Steele dossier was not properly vetted by the media. There's certainly some introspection from folks who ran along with that story uncritically. But you know, it can't be a shrugging of the shoulders, or we're going to see institutional trust in media continue to erode even further. I mean, there have to be more than retractions, I would hope.
Well, what I'd hope is that that liberalism would recover its soul. Maybe because I'm older than our two young reporters that we have here, our excellent reporters. We have Andy on the show today, Emily and Phil. Joseph McCarthy, the notorious red-baiting Joseph McCarthy, stood and famously he was at a speech, actually well before I was born, but it was 1950. But he held up his hand and he said, I have in my hand the names of 205 known communists who work in the State Department. And the number would fluctuate wildly from town to town. Sometimes it was 57. He never would release those names. Sometimes he was holding nothing in his hand. Sometimes he was just holding up his hand. The press was much more skeptical of that. This is supposedly the touchstone of modern liberalism, that kind of smears of people, that kind of calling people disloyal. And it was the same thing. It's Russians. Now, that was Republicans, and now this is Democrats. But it's the same trope, and it's the same tactic. And for liberals and the media to fall for it, it sickens me, Andy. I'm astonished that this took place. And I'm grateful to people like Matt Taibbi and Emily for pointing it out. And Jeff Girth, writing in Columbia Journalism Review this week, for calling this out, because we need a reset here in journalism.
I will say, and I don't want to turn this podcast into love fest, but Emily, I will say that I've read a lot of these Twitter files. Your story, and this one in particular, was so clear what was going on and why it was, as Carl said, why it was so wrong, that I commend this article to everyone. It's in the Federalist. You can find it. But let's move on. Carl, I want to talk to you about the docudrama, as we call it here on the podcast. It's continuing. Biden's beach house in Rehoboth was searched on Wednesday by the FBI. Mike Pence is probably going to get a visit soon, it looks like. Now, there's been some complaints that these searches are not really going to contribute to any sort of prosecution at any point. The evidence is so tainted that we can learn nothing from them. But it doesn't seem to be going away. It doesn't seem to be passing. And if you're Joe Biden, you're looking at the State of the Union, then you're looking at a presidential announcement. You're probably hoping this would have gone off the front burner by now.
Yeah, it's funny because some Democrats were happy when some papers apparently marked classified turned up in Mike Pence's study or wherever it was. I don't think Joe Biden was one of those Democrats who were happy. I think he would like this to go away. I was pointed to the special prosecutor. That's what he'd hope to be able to say. And he'd hope the special prosecutor would take 2 years to deal with it. He would never have to worry about these idiots at the Justice Department indicting Donald Trump. That was off the table. I think Biden thought it was fine. And then the Pence thing comes up. And it's like, does anybody in this government know how to keep a secret, follow the law, store their papers properly? It sort of makes everybody look bad. And it reminded people once again of the rather, in hindsight, intemperate things Joe Biden himself said about Donald Trump's ability to store papers properly. I'm going to reiterate this because I say it every time, and I may be proven spectacularly wrong about this, but my own guess is that there's nothing in these papers that really compromises national security, and that the real problem here is the vast overclassification system, and the stuff is lumped in there because people know it isn't sensitive. That's my guess. That's my gut. That's my hunch. And of course, we may never get to know because the government protects these secrets even when they send people to prison. And we never get to find out what was in the papers. But I hope both sides, since both sides are implicated, would come together. Instead of the Republicans grandstanding the way they want to now about the Biden papers, would say, all right, let's take a holistic view here. What's the issue? And let's start with this. How are things classified? And why is there so much classified for us? Let's start there. And then let's just go on and we'll develop some procedures for classification and for storing. And you could actually turn this into a teachable moment if we had a functional democracy, which is an open question.
It still wouldn't answer the question of the double standard.
Well, you say that, Eddie, but I don't think they can indict Trump now. I got to tell you, I don't see how that could happen.
Sorry, no, I meant the double standard. If that had been you or me or any low-level employee of the State Department or in the military, and we had done this, we'd be in handcuffs. You know that.
Well, that's one way to look at it, Andy. How about this? If a low-level person was going through their files or either had the top secret document, I would hope they'd have the sense to put it in the fireplace. I mean,
that's one way to solve it. But Phil, you're over in the White House. It's been a tough week for her, hasn't it? Trying to answer these questions. Do you have any sympathy?
I absolutely do have sympathy for Karine Jean-Pierre, because either deliberately or as part of a strategy to limit the political fallout, she has been left in the dark. White House counsel isn't bringing her on board when they know certain things. She's not getting a heads up when it comes to any of these DOJ actions. In fact, she has told us on numerous occasions that she's learned of these searches from our reporting in the press. And then the other day, you know, the White House counsel's spokesperson had their own press conference outside of the White House there in the driveway, clearly an attempt to create some distance between the official White House podium and, you know, the White House counsel's office, and said once again that Biden had been complying with the law, completely cooperative, and had been transparent. The problem in all of this is whether Cannon is correct in his contention is that we have an over-classification problem, or there was some perhaps graft or use of these documents for personal advantage. The problem is that the White House hasn't gotten their story straight. And I feel sympathy for Karine Jean-Pierre, because she's taking all these slings and arrows and all this incoming fire when what she has been told is correct ends up being inaccurate. For instance, we learned just this week that the FBI searched the Biden Penn Center last November. We didn't hear about that at the moment, and we certainly didn't hear about that when they were being transparent in their mind about all of the different searches that had occurred. I think, once again, this is a situation where, regardless of how severe the crime is, the cover-up here is politically, you know, that's the problem for the Biden administration. They're not giving the American people the perception that they're playing it straight. And we'll see if his poll numbers go down as a result.
Yeah, Emily, I was going to ask about that. I mean, what is the real long-term political damage here for Biden, do you think?
That's a good question, because it's the fatigue I think the American people have of hearing one person did something that is incomparably bad, and then finding evidence it was in fact done by that same person who was accusing the other person of doing something that was incomparably bad and impeachable or criminal or whatever it is. It happens over and over again. And I know a lot of people get sick, especially on the left, of both sides-ism, where you're just equating both sides. But this isn't like such a crystal clear illustration of the fact that it is really both sides. We had to get caught up in this silly thing with the Trump documents that has a there's something substantially concerning, right, about espionage, for instance, at Mar-a-Lago and the documents. And when all of this broke, we didn't really know what the documents are. We still don't know what the Biden documents are. We don't know what the Pence documents are, really. And so with all of that in mind, we had to go through this appointment of a special counsel, this conversation about criminal penalties. And it turns out Biden has them in multiple locations. Mike Pence has 12 documents. So I think the political damage for Biden is to continue having this in the news, period, because it reminds people of what happened with Trump. It reminds people that they had this bait and switch pulled on them by the Biden administration and by a lot of his watchdogs in the media, or I'm sorry, lapdogs in the media, who immediately rushed to condemn Trump and rushed to defend Biden. Nobody knows what to believe anymore. Nobody knows, you know, which analysis is fair anymore. And this is to the extent that Biden contributes to that exasperation among the American people, I think that's the damage to his presidency.
The White House will tell you, look at the polling. The American people don't hold Biden accountable for this, and his poll numbers haven't changed. This week, they pointed to a CBS News poll that was recently conducted in particular. And I found that very strange, because it wasn't necessarily vindication. It was just evidence that thus far, the American people buy their argument that they've done everything by the book and they've been transparent. I think that you should take that poll a little bit later and see, now that we know that there was an FBI search that wasn't disclosed, and as these things continue to snowball, if that changes. But one thing that was interesting in that CBS News poll that they continue to point to as cover is that more and more the American public, now that there have been documents discovered with Pence, Trump, and Biden, they're just under the impression, oh, well, everybody takes classified information with them out of the office. And I think that the American public is just maybe not satisfied with this, but they expect that there's one set of rules for, you know, people who govern, and there's another set of rules for the second lieutenant intelligence officer.
Carl?
Well, there's I thought of it in another way, trying to figure out what the political fallout is. Remember, so Joe Biden is going to be 82 on election day in 2024. At the end of last year, a lot of people, Democrats.
I think Carl brings that up because it makes him feel young, especially in this group, but go ahead.
A lot of Democrats are privately, not publicly, saying they expected Biden would not run for re-election. After the midterm elections turned out more favorably than most people thought for the Democrats, that talk was muted. Biden himself sent out surrogates to talk about it, the president's policies are popular, and began hinting he was going to announce that he was going to run for re-election. This week, something took place. Phil was one of the people who broke the story. Nikki Haley announced she's going to run for president in the Republican primary against Donald Trump. She had previously said she wouldn't run against Donald Trump. All the talking heads on the networks who want Nikki Haley to go away so that Trump can lose to Biden again kept bringing this up, like, and expect her to have an answer for it. Of course, the answer for it, Haley is not going to give. The answer is, well, that was before I said that before he led a riot when he lost an election. So I don't feel bound by it. Now, Nikki Haley's not going to say that, but everybody knows that that's part of the equation. Well, there are Democrats. I'm thinking of the governor of California as one of them. There are others, prominent Democrats, who have said they would not run against Joe Biden. It seems to me that if you have enough of these events, and this in particular, the special prosecutor is classified events, you have one more thing like that, you've taken these guys off the hook. They can run. And some of them will run against Joe Biden in the primaries. If it becomes apparent to one of these guys that they have a chance to beat Biden and that he's damaged goods and he may not be the party's strongest nominee, I think you'll see one or more of these people go the Nikki Haley route. Now, they won't announce it yet. It's a different situation. But they won't have to say, oh, well, that, you know, I didn't know Joe Biden was stealing documents. I didn't know Hunter Biden was doing X, Y, and Z. But the point is, if he becomes damaged goods in that way, what could be the political fallout is he gets a Democratic Party challenger in 2024.
That's interesting. I think that's actually has the ring of truth about it. Emily, what about Mike Pence in all this? Because Mike Pence is an interesting fellow in that, you know, obviously Trump's vice president, then for the Democrats, sort of a hero of January 6th and sort of this reappreciation of the man. And I'll put it this way. I mean, I don't think anyone's really surprised that Trump doesn't really care about a lot of rules. I mean, that's his brand, right? Uncle Joe leaves a couple documents next to his Corvette. You know, again, it's in character, right? Mike Pence is the sort of Boy Scout in this group. And for him to sort of end up having to raise his hand and say, oh, me too, by the way, it's off brand. Is it more damaging because of that? Or is it less damaging because people say, well, you know, Mike Pence is a Boy Scout. He wouldn't do something like that.
Well, since you bring it up, Andy, the Eagle Scout of this group is Philip Wegman. We are in the presence of an Eagle Scout, a great Eagle Scout.
Yeah, it was cool in high school. Whatever.
But Pence's problem is the juxtaposition of those sound bites, in that he has this interview with David Muir where he says very clearly, I did not take classified documents. And then you find classified documents. Again, if you have to defend Mike Pence in this situation, the very clear defense is that he probably had documents he would never have thought were actually classified material because we're just wildly overclassifying so many documents. So I understand why someone would make statement A and then have to deal with situation B. But in a potential presidential run, I think you're completely right, Andy. The rule following is sort of baked into the Mike Pence cake. That's part of his sell. It's part of the route that he thinks gives him an edge over Donald Trump, that there's this lane here for a candidate who can appeal to voters who want norms protected and preserved in the same way that Joe Biden, from the Democratic perspective, said he might do it, or sort of falsely told voters that he would be able to do that. So it really erodes his credibility on that note. You can see the clip being played over and over again in a primary competition. And that is just, it is really bad for Mike Pence on the sort of political level. On the substantive level, I understand why he probably said what he said, because he just didn't expect to have 12 classified documents when his lawyer found them. He had a lawyer look just to make sure that what he said was correct afterwards. And that's when he found these 12 documents. So it is damaging specifically and maybe only because of what his brand is.
So the Pence theory of the case is that no one gets a merit badge for mishandling documents, but they do get brownie points for following all of the rules. Mark Short, Pence's longtime political aide, does an interview shortly after documents are discovered at the Biden Penn Center. And he says that the real crime for Trump was that he was not forthright with the FBI and DOJ about the documents that were in Mar-a-Lago, and that we're going to learn more about what happened with Biden's documents. Since then, we've seen that Biden has not been forthright with the American people. This story has evolved over time. And, there doesn't seem to be any indication that he, called off the DOJ or FBI or did anything officially wrong there. But the Pence theory of the case, if it comes down to a primary, is I was big enough to admit when I made a mistake and I immediately moved forward to fix things. And I've always been straight with you, unlike Biden and Trump. But do the American people care about classified documents during a primary? Maybe not.
Spoken like a true Eagle Scout. You get points for being honest. Carl, we're going to wrap up, but any thoughts? We're looking ahead to the State of the Union next week. Any predictions, thoughts, reflections?
Well, presidents like to say, they like to be able to go out and say the State of the Union is strong. And sometimes when presidents first come into office and they want to say that it's not strong because they're about to make it strong. Well, Biden's been there 2 years now. And he's old school, and he wants to say he's going to want to point to achievements. That's what he's going to want to do. He'll do some of the culture war stuff. His speechwriters are very into it, and he doesn't seem to object. But I think what he'll do is he'll talk about unemployment. The unemployment rate is going down, and people are, and we've emerged from COVID. And I think he'll try and appeal to the better angels of our nature and give a speech that's relatively upbeat for the way these things go these days. I think what Biden wants to project is that he's presiding over a successful presidency.
Well, I have only one prediction, which is that he will not mention his 1967 Corvette in this speech. Well, I want to thank Emily Jasinski, Phil Wegman, and Carl Cannon. We're usually here Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays in some form. So bookmark this podcast. Come back often. You can keep up with what we're up to at the podcast by signing up for the free RCP Takeaway newsletter from Real Clear Politics. And you can also sign up for Carl Cannon's Morning Note. State of the Union is coming up. A good way to prepare for an evening of shouting at the TV is to go to Real Clear Politics and read one article from a writer or publication with whom you disagree. Thank you for listening. Until next time, for Real Clear Politics, I'm Andrew Walworth.